Nukes are in the news. March 8th, 2009. Headline, will U.S. attack Pakistan to secure nuclear weapons? March 11th, U.S.-Israel disagree on Iran arms threat. April 5th, North Korea's defiant rocket launch. April 6th, after North Korea's launch, Obama focuses on disarmament. April 13th, UN Security Council condemns North Korean rocket launch. April 13th, again, Iran says it welcomes nuclear talks with West. April 14th, North Korea to restart nuclear weapons plant. How big a threat is North Korea? Will Iran go nuclear? Will Israel attack Iran? Are nukes safe in Pakistan? Are they safe in the former Soviet Union? Can Obama really move toward nuclear disarmament? The North Korean missile launch was a failure. President Obama, while in Europe, called for an end to nuclear weapons. Newt Gingrich labeled that fantasy, even though Ronald Reagan had asked for the same thing many years ago. What can we expect from the new hardline government in Israel with regards to Iran? And what can we expect from Iran as it moves toward the presidential election in June? And then what about Pakistan and India? It's time to talk with nuclear weapons expert Joe Cirincione. Joe Cirincione joined Plowshares Fund as president in March 2008. He previously served as senior vice president for national security and international policy at the Center for American Progress and as director for nonproliferation at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace. He's co-author of Universal Compliance, A Strategy for Nuclear Security, author of Deadly Arsenals, Nuclear, Biological, and Chemical Threats, and his newest, back in 2007, Bomb Scare, The History and Future of Nuclear Weapons. 2005 Nobel Peace Prize winner Mohamed El-Baradei, the Director General of the International Atomic Energy Agency, praises Bomb Scare. Quote, at a time of challenges and uncertainties regarding the nuclear nonproliferation and disarmament regime, the book offers a comprehensive review of the history and the theory of nuclear weapons, as well as of the policy options before us today in our common endeavor to address the most pressing threats, existing arsenals, the emergence of new nuclear-armed states, and nuclear terrorism. Welcome, Joseph Cirincione.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
I like listeners to get a feel for the people behind the work and the ideas. At what point in your life did you begin to focus on nuclear weapons, and why?
Focus. I think my earliest memory was probably as a kid and the air raid drills that we had. The nuns at St. Rita's Grammar School would line us up for drills every couple of months, or reading Failsafe when it was serialized in the Saturday Evening Post. But I didn't really get serious about it professionally until I joined the staff of the House Armed Services Committee back in 1985, and I was assigned oversight responsibility for the Star Wars program, the Strategic Defense Initiative, and also started working on programs like the MX missile and the B-1 bomber. And that's where I started to get intimately familiar with both the procurement of nuclear weapons and the strategy and doctrine that accompanied them. And the more years I spent on that, the less sense all of this made. And I began working with members who were trying to reduce the number of nuclear weapons in the world and change our nuclear strategy. And I've pretty much been at it ever since.
Right. And looks like your job's still, still out there. Yeah. No. As I say sometimes to folks, no problem scheduling this show. The problem's sticking around.
They do. There's always a crisis. So when I became director of the Carnegie Nonproliferation Project in April of 1998, about a month later, India and Pakistan detonated their nuclear tests. The phone started ringing, and it really hasn't stopped. There often seems to be a crisis a week.
Right. So you heard those headlines that I went through.
That's a long list. How long is your show?
Half an hour.
Okay.
But let's hit as many of them as we can, and basically that's the show. First, North Korea. They did a launch. I believe it's a failure. Obama responds. But let's just talk about North Korea. What is the state of their program? How much of a threat are they? And does it matter that their stance right now? I think usually after a failure, they return to the table soon. But this time, they're going from failure to more aggression, at least in their talk.
This is part of the North Korean dance. We have seen this pattern repeated over and over again, and they are constantly trying to sort of puff themselves up with bluster and tests in order to get attention and to increase their negotiating position for what they want. They feel that they've been ignored by the United States, that they have not gotten the security assurance or the economic aid that they were promised in exchange for pausing their program and beginning its dismantlement. The good news here is that for the last year, they have stopped making plutonium, they've stopped making the stuff of bombs, and have started dismantling their nuclear facilities. They then felt that the Obama administration wasn't paying attention to them when they came in, didn't get anywhere near the attention that Iran did, for example. Nothing like the kind of gestures that Obama made, and they have a small point there. They did this missile test, which was an impressive display of technology. There's some serious missile hardware they put on display. Fortunately, the overall test failed, so I think it set their program back rather than advancing it. They were condemned by the United Nations just yesterday, and in response, they're doing this gesture, throwing out the inspectors, threatening to restart their plutonium production facility. I believe that this will end back at the negotiating table. This is all posturing and bargaining position for them. It depends how adroit the Obama administration is and how concerned China is. That's our essential partner into convincing them to come back and settle these differences. If the past patterns stay with us, I expect we'll see North Korea back at the bargaining table within 3 or 4 weeks.
The balance between getting attention from somebody and testing nuclear weapons is a little crazy. But was there some truth to the fact that they were not getting the aid that had been promised in the bargain?
Yes, there is. And I'll do this very quickly. The last administration, the Bush administration, was plagued with a fundamental divide between pragmatists like Secretary of State Colin Powell and later Condoleezza Rice, who wanted to make a deal with the North Koreans, and the hardliners like Vice President Cheney and Donald Rumsfeld, who said, we don't negotiate with evil, we destroy it. And what that meant was we proceeded with one foot on the gas, one foot on the brake. Every time talk seemed to be going someplace, the hardliners in our country would put in a new demand or put in a new sanction that would wreck the talk, that would cause the North Koreans to accuse us of going back on our word, and often that was true. So in this case, we had gotten an agreement with them on dismantlement, and we were negotiating over the verification. How do we know we're doing what you do, what you say? They gave us verbal assurances. This is last year,
mm-hmm.
And the vice president insisted that it be in written form. The North Koreans balked at that, wouldn't put it in written form.
Oh, God.
And in retaliation, the U.S. stopped supporting the delivery of fuel oil. So we're just talking about oil here, tons of oil that we were giving them. The North Koreans, in response to that, stopped the dismantlement process, and things spiraled in that kind of tit-for-tat way.
And how has
the point that they launched a rocket?
And how has the Obama administration responded, or how are they dealing with that piece of it, the piece that there was an exchange in place that wasn't being honored?
The North Koreans are extremely difficult to deal with, but I have to say the Obama administration dropped the ball here. They transferred the chief negotiator, Assistant Secretary, the assistant secretary who was working on this and made Chris Hill the ambassador to Iraq. But there is no new assistant secretary to take his place yet. We appointed a special envoy, but he's only part-time. He's not really on the job full-time yet. And so these negotiations did falter. Into that space is where the North Koreans
mm-hmm.
saw their opportunity. And by the way, the supreme leader, Kim Jong-il, is actually ill, and there's something of a secession struggle going on. Whenever that happens, there tends to be a shift to the right, a sort of a hardline shift as everyone curries support of the military. So all these are the factors that are leading up to this. The question is, can we get back on track
mm-hmm.
Before it spirals out of control?
And finally, one last very specific question, which is that I labeled the launch a failure. I believe the North Koreans labeled it a success, but what are you, I think you've said that there are two or three key things
yeah.
that they lack at this point, and then we'll finish with North Korea.
Yeah, this was a new kind of rocket. We hadn't seen this one before, and it is impressive, and it went farther than previous rockets, but its third stage failed, And so the third stage with the satellite fell into the Pacific Ocean along with the second stage. So it didn't achieve its objective of putting a small satellite, oh, about 300 pounds into space. Even if it had succeeded, however, it falls short of a true nuclear-tipped intercontinental ballistic missile capability. To do that, they would need a bigger rocket that can carry a bigger payload. A nuclear weapon is typically about a ton, so 2,000 pounds. They're nowhere near that. They need one that can fly farther, not to the middle of the Pacific Ocean, but all the way across in order to be able to strike at California. They're not near that. And finally, they need a reentry vehicle. It's one thing to put something up into space. It's a whole other technological challenge to bring it back down. So a hardened reentry vehicle with a warhead, a nuclear warhead that can withstand the vibrations, temperature changes, and gravitational forces that will rip less sturdy warheads apart. So they're heading in that direction. There's still several years from that capability.
Right, so there's plenty of time for negotiation.
Yes.
So now let's move to, as I said, Obama's response to this launch was actually a call for disarmament, I think all the way to a world without nuclear weapons. The right immediately, I know Newt Gingrich said this is fantasy policy. They immediately said this was unrealistic. I saw an editorial in the Wall Street Journal that said this is a bad idea because it gets away from deterrence. What is Obama suggesting, and what do you think the possibilities really are?
With two statements, President Obama has fundamentally begun the process of transforming U.S. nuclear policy. The first was April 1st, where he, in a joint statement with Russian President Dmitry Medvedev, said that the U.S. and Russia would focus on their own arsenals and would start the process of making what they call bold reductions in the nuclear force. The two of us together have about 96% of the estimated 23,000 nuclear weapons in the world. So the rest of the world looks at us, the nuclear powers, to take these kinds of first steps. Obama and Medvedev recognized their special obligations, special commitments, and decided to do exactly that. They also both committed to a world without nuclear weapons. And a few days later in Prague, on April 5th, President Obama outlined his plan for how to do that. He embraced the goal, so we're no longer going to be talking about a U.S. nuclear policy that supports the indefinite maintenance of thousands of warheads. Now, he said, our policies would be geared towards their elimination, beginning with the reductions that he already mentioned, and ratification of a test ban treaty that the U.S. signed 10 years ago but the Senate never ratified, that would ban nuclear tests everywhere, working with other countries to secure all the loose nukes and other weapons material that terrorists could steal and fashion into a bomb, working to strengthen the non-proliferation treaty to prevent countries like North Korea or Iran from getting the weapons, and about a dozen other programmatic steps. The key here was his embrace of the vision of saying this is where we're going, and that makes all the difference, because now he starts to put us all on equal footing, away from the world where some countries, the United States and Russia, for example, are allowed to have nuclear weapons while the others are prohibited from doing so. That is an unstable dynamic. It can't last.
And also, Joseph, am I correct that in the non-proliferation treaty, when it was first set up, the states possessing, primarily U.S. and Russia, agreed that their side of the bargain would be to do away with nuclear weapons. The side of the bargain of those who didn't have them yet was to not pursue them, et cetera, et cetera. Yes?
Exactly. And that's what Medvedev and Obama mentioned as their special obligations. We have to live up to our part of the bargain. As countries come to believe that we're never going to disarm, they start recalculating their possibilities. And not just rogue states, but allies like Japan,
mm-hmm.
who could build a nuclear weapon in 2 or 3 months if they wanted to. And other countries start to reconsider whether they need nuclear weapons. Obama gets this, and he promised that he was going to reduce the importance of nuclear weapons in our own security strategy, understanding that as long as the most powerful military country in the world insists that it needs nuclear weapons for its security, it's much harder to convince countries like Iran that they don't.
So this is actually one of the biggest changes that the Obama administration has signaled, isn't it?
Yes, it is. And it's on par with the other kind of transformational changes he's seeking on the healthcare system, the energy sector, mm-hmm. the education sector. Now he's saying he's going to do it for nuclear policy as well. I've been waiting my whole life for a president to make a speech like this.
Very good. And what has been the international response?
Overwhelmingly positive. There's many countries that have already embraced this, like Great Britain. The UK Prime Minister Gordon Brown has said that he wants the United Kingdom to be in the forefront of the global nuclear disarmament campaign. He wants to make his country what he calls a disarmament laboratory, exploring ways that we could actually verify this.
Mm-hmm.
How do you actually, when you get down to very low numbers, make sure that nobody's cheating on it? Nobody knows yet. They're sponsoring studies, and they have their nuclear labs working on verification technology. France has submitted a very ambitious non-proliferation and disarmament proposal on the part of the European Union. We've gotten positive responses from China, some positive statements from India, who's now talking about ratifying the comprehensive test ban as well.
Really?
Yeah.
Okay, that's big news. Now, let me ask you, what does one say to those who say that mutual assured destruction, the deterrence theory, it goes out the window if the U.S. and Russia actually disarm and then perhaps leaves rogue nations in a uniquely powerful position? What's the answer to that?
Well, there's three things. One is nobody's talking about doing this overnight. It took us 64 years to get into this nuclear mess. It's going to take us a couple of decades to get out.
And Obama actually said that as well.
Yeah, so we don't know when we're going to be able to do this. Most experts think it'll take us about 20 years, and we'll proceed step by step, and every step will make us safer.
Mm-hmm.
The fewer weapons there are, the less chance that they'll be used or stolen by
mm-hmm.
terrorists, etc. So that's one thing. Deterrence is going to be with us for another couple of decades or so. The second thing is deterrence, you know, it works great until it doesn't. And then it's catastrophic, and that's the deterrence trap. Thinking that everyone's going to behave rationally and there aren't going to be any mistakes or miscalculations. I mean, most experts understand that we escaped a global thermonuclear war during the Cold War period by luck.
Yeah.
By luck. That there were numerous occasions we went right up to the edge and just avoided it, but by the slimmest of margins. And people who lived through that question whether we're going to be as lucky in the next 50 years as we were in the past 50 years. And finally, this is an issue, it's not just U.S. and Russia that matters here. We're talking about war between other states with less command and control measures.
Well, I'm thinking of India and Pakistan
exactly.
being the scariest, too.
Exactly.
And in the future, that could be Israel and Iran, but right now it's India and Pakistan.
That's exactly right. So in the South Asia is where most experts expect us to see a nuclear weapon used for the first time since World War II in combat. Two nuclear armed nations, each with enough material for 100 nuclear weapons, they've gone to war three times in the last 50 years. They almost went to war just back in 2000, 2001, when they were both nuclear armed.
Mm-hmm.
Again, we just escaped that. And if Iran were to get nuclear weapons, it wouldn't stop there. Iran's Sunni Arab rivals,
right,
which would try to rival them. Looking at a Middle East with not two nuclear powers, Israel and Iran, but three, four, or five, with the underlying conflicts, that's a recipe for nuclear war.
What does the new hardline government in Israel and the upcoming election in Iran, what are those implications for nuclear policy?
Yeah, well, with Netanyahu assuming the prime ministership and with Mr. Lieberman becoming his foreign minister, you have the most conservative right-wing government in Israel's history. And Prime Minister Netanyahu has a very hard line both on the Palestinian question. He refuses to even talk about a two-state solution there. And on Iran, where he repeatedly talks about striking out at Iran. And just yesterday, you had Shimon Peres, who's also part of this unity government, leader of the Labor Party, talk about striking at Iran, too. There's two things, or maybe three, going on there. One is that they're both, all these statements are primarily for domestic consumption. They're both trying to show that they're the stronger, they're the tougher guy, but then the Likud Party is in a rivalry with the Labor Party. The second is that this is aimed at the United States. They know we're now in negotiations with Iran. The United States is about to join what the negotiations that the Europeans have had with Iran over its nuclear program. We're now going to sit down as part of that process, the first direct negotiations the U.S. has had with the Islamic Republic since the revolution. And the Israelis want to stiffen our spines. They don't want to see us making any concessions. So they keep talking about strikes, strikes, strikes. Third, and here's the final thing that's going on, is I don't believe Israel is going to strike at Iran. The Joint Chiefs in our country are dead set against this. For Israel to conduct such a strike, they would need our assistance, including overflying Iraqi airspace, which we still control. The Joint Chiefs have said on several occasions that strikes on Iran would threaten the U.S. position in Iraq and Afghanistan, would start a third war in the Middle East. It's the last thing we want to see happening right now.
I know that there have been other times when Israel has taken action, perhaps, doing away with a weapons factory in Syria and Iraq many years ago. But your belief is that this time the U.S. being against it and the need for U.S. Involvement means that the U.S. can actually stop it.
Well, so much to say just about that, but let me just try. The Oseraq reactor, which Israel hit in Iraq in 1981, it's widely seen. The Wall Street Journal claims this is the major proliferation success of the past four decades. It actually was a failure. They hit the Israeli reactor, put it out of business.
The Iraqi reactor,
right. Put it out of business before it could open up. They were afraid that he would use this to secretly make material for a bomb. It did knock out the reactor, but it drove the bomb program underground, where Saddam expanded it tenfold and started working on a secret centrifuge project that came very close to making a nuclear weapon and probably would have if it hadn't been interrupted by the 1991 Iraq War. At that time, Israel and the U.S. were not aware of the program, or at least the extent of the program. So there's a real downside to those kinds of strikes. And in Iran, the problem is that it's not, it wouldn't be the last move. It doesn't solve the problem. It would start another conflict in the region, start a war between Iran and the United States or Israel, and it would probably accelerate the Iranian nuclear program. The debate in Iran about whether to get a bomb would be over. They'd be rushing as fast as they could to get one, and it would prove the argument that if you feel threatened,
right,
by
best get a bomb. Yeah. So we don't even have time to talk about what I believe you have called the most dangerous place in the world, which is Pakistan. And people, you know about that one, that there you have a country that's in great turmoil and has nuclear weapons, and as we said, is next door to another country in which it has disagreements.
And it has Osama bin Laden.
That's right.
In it. So I think Osama bin Laden is closer to a bomb than he ever has been. That's why it's so urgent to stabilize and reform Pakistan.
Yeah, and about Pakistan, it's not so much, in other words, action wouldn't be about the bombs. Action would be about stabilizing the government, stabilizing the country.
That's exactly right. And again, this is how Obama gets it right. He understands you need a global, comprehensive solution. Like, you can't go around playing nuclear whack-a-mole and expect to win that game.
Okay, I got to let you go. The book is Bomb Scare. The website is plowshares.org. You can listen to this week's conversation and many other during the week by linking to our podcast. You can also sign up to have that delivered to you weekly. Thank you, Joe Cirincione. Keep up the good work.